We really have one big story to cover this week. We're talking about the largest crypto hack in history.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Every week, we roll up our sleeves and delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit the subscribe button for your weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are that of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto's a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently.
Hey guys, good morning.
Good morning, happy Friday.
Good morning.
It's been a long crypto week.
It really has, hasn't it? It's been a long crypto year so far, when you think about it. It's like since the election season in the US, like the news cycle has been like fire hose learning. Like fire hose trying to stay up to speed.
I would maybe bucket this week as a different type of fire hose, maybe a little bit less positive.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It's almost like this reckoning was coming at some point.
I feel like one thing which I've completely lost pulse on is just meme coins in the last month and a half. I think I was tracking them until December last year, but now it's just way too many. And now there's a lot of important personalities involved in meme coins.
I know. There was a bill. I think there was a bill that was proposed to basically prevent politicians from launching meme coins.
Really?
That happened this week. Yeah. I forget who proposed it, but I suppose that was only a matter of time, right?
Yeah, that seemed like it was definitely in the works.
Yeah. You know what I am interested? With the conference season coming up, what sentiment is going to be like? Like, are people going to be back to their... Because it last few years, like maybe this last year, people were relatively positive, but a couple years before that, the tone was relatively sobering. but, you know, yeah, we have Consensus. Oh, ETH Denver's this week. We have Consensus coming up. We have Bitcoin 25 coming up. So it's going to be a busy spring for sure.
What's interesting now is that I'm also seeing a lot of thematic conferences in crypto. So Circle just did a stablecoin conference. There's another conference solely focused on wallets. That tells you that there is some level of maturity happening versus, you know, just being a crypto conference. It's just for stable coins or it's just for payments.
Yeah, I generally like those forums. I feel like they're more productive. All right, should we jump in?
I think we should. I mean, we really have one big story to cover this week, and we're going to spend a lot of time talking about it because there are a lot of different angles here. But I think just a level set, right? We're talking about Bybit. We're talking about the largest crypto hack in history. I think we need to start and just talk about how exchanges think about hot and cold wallets, how these operations work, just so that we can all be on the same page.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And so to understand the hack, I think it's important for us to grasp how a lot of these exchanges function. And the way these exchanges function is that they have two types of wallet. So you have one wallet, which is your hot wallet, which are typically online. Those are the ones that are connected to the internet. And the idea for these hot wallets is to build for speed and handling deposits, withdrawals, real time. On the other side, you have cold wallets, and that ties well into the Bybit story. Cold wallets are offline storage solutions. And the most important point here is that exchanges store around 87 to 90% of their funds in cold wallets. And that's exactly what got affected here. So one part which is worth calling out is that for any cold wallet, for a sophisticated exchange, the private keys are typically split across multiple parties using something like multisig, which means that you kind of need a mechanism where you need 3 out of 5 authorized signature or sometimes 5 out of 5 authorized signatures. And the scary part about Bybit is that even though you did have a multisig mechanism, there was still this massive hack.
It's probably a good transition into how it actually happened.
That's what I was going to say. I think we have to talk about this.
And I think we should probably preface this by saying there's still, I mean, I think we have a pretty good idea, but a lot of the intelligence around what actually happened, and the forensic evaluation is still very much in flight, right? Like, I think even this week, a lot has come to light, right? That has kind of changed the overall kind of threat profile of this, right, in terms of how it was facilitated.
Yeah, absolutely. Gautam, do you want to explain how the hack happened?
Sure, yeah. So to give some context, and I should preface this, that this is a developing story, so more details are kind of expected to emerge. For those who don't know, Bybit is a prominent cryptocurrency exchange based in Dubai, and they manage a substantial amount of digital assets for global clientele. And to ensure security, Bybit utilizes a combination of cold wallets and hot wallets for managing funds, right? So on February 21st, the Bybit team initiated a standard procedure of transferring funds from their Ethereum cold wallet to a warm wallet. So as you guys have mentioned, the process is, you know, pretty much like a multi-signature holder where you need to approve a transaction collectively. So you ensure that no single individual has unilateral control over the significant funds, right? And unbeknownst to Bybit, the North Korean hacking group known as the Lazarus Group had been meticulously kind of planning an attack where they targeted the Safe Wallet, which is a platform used by Bybit, used for managing their multi-signature wallets. So in terms of how the hack happened, basically it was along the lines of a social engineering and phishing attack. So the attackers essentially employed social engineering techniques to deceive the developer. There were a couple of registered deceptive domains that actually were confirmed recently with the Bybit-assessments, which led credence to some malicious communication. But through some phishing, you know, potentially some messaging, the attackers tricked a developer into downloading some executable malware. And that malicious software kind of granted the attackers unauthorized access to like a developer's machine. Now, once they were inside the developer's system, the malware kind of harvested sensitive credentials, which includes access keys to like the Safe Wallet's Amazon Web Services infrastructure, right? And with those stolen credentials from AWS, the attacker infiltrated the Safe Wallet cloud environment. So specifically targeting some storage, in this case, an S3 bucket, where the platform web application assets were stored, right? And then there was some JavaScript injection involved where basically that malicious code was then crafted and activated only under a specific condition, particularly when accessing Bybit systems.
So maybe if we go into real specifics around what exactly happened, because I know it's a lot of information, and I think I want to really almost dumb it down on exactly what happened.
I think that was a good explanation, though. That's far better than I would have done. So I appreciate that. But for those who don't know what an S3 bucket is, right? which was probably most people, but now maybe some people on this call do after this hack, right? I would include myself in that group.
So one part which I think is worth calling out is how the North Korean hackers executed this evil genius heist, right? So initially they started out by infiltrating Bybit's internal systems, which is, you know, mostly possibly done using a phishing attack months before the hack happened. And this is really common standard pattern for Lazarus Group, which is a North Korean hacker group. There's no way that they could have cracked the cold wallet, but what they did was they targeted the approval process. And that's where the evil genius lies. So they deployed a fake UI, which had the fake version of transaction approval. And the scary part is the fake UI mimicked the real one to the T. So think about same design, same numbers, same addresses, but the only difference was instead of that money being a routine operation where it goes from a cold wallet to Bybit's hot wallet, it just went to a smart contract which they controlled. Like, think about it this way. How scary is it that all signers saw the mass UI, which showed the correct address on the UI? It also showed the URL coming from Safe, which is how they do multisig. However, just the signing message had a small change in the contract logic, which essentially gave them access to the account. So this is the part which I think is, like, imagine you're signing a check to pay rent, and then someone swaps it with a fake one that looks identical, and now, you know, you're sending money to a scammer. So that's kind of the analogy here, which is, you know, they kind of replaced all the things which look similar, except the final part, which is where does the money go to?
So that is the social engineering aspect to this, right? I think the other thing that we definitely should probably mention is so that is obviously kind of the beginning of this attack. But the other piece that, you know, is, you know, within Bybit's control, and is probably being reevaluated at this point, is the fact that, you know, as you think about these multi-sig wallets, they were, you know, I think it was a 3 of 3, right? So they needed, you know, three signers. The transactions that are being signed by each one of those signers were being blind signed, right? So when they were validating that these transactions are accurate on a hardware device, they actually weren't able to view the details associated with this transaction, because they would, if they were not blind signing, they would have been able to see, okay, wait a second, the details of this transaction are not matching up with what they should be on the hardware device itself, right? So I think that's another thing. And a lot of people do that, right? Like blind signing, I think in general, in the industry is viewed as not a great practice for that reason, right? Because you can't independently verify that the transaction hasn't been tampered with on the device. But that's not to say that it's not, you know, used by, you know, market participants, right? Clearly Bybit was doing it. And I'm sure they're not the only ones that, you know, employ this practice as part of their wallet management, you know, procedures.
Right. And I think it's important to add that, like, the UI that they were blind signing on is widely used within retail and institutional crypto, right? And I think it's well known that just due to the design, you can't see the entire ETH transaction. And that's a design problem on this UI. But it's not to say that they're the only ones using this. You know, it is widely used, and I'm sure will be post-mortem reevaluated. So it's something that they shouldn't have been doing operationally, but also from a UX design perspective on the side of the wallet, like, it's a problem that needs to be addressed.
Well, one thing which I thought was really interesting and which kind of got me down the rabbit hole of understanding how the hackers got access to all three signers' laptops and their systems, right? That's the most interesting part, because the whole point of multi-sig is to decentralize the risk. And so I, you know, it was a little eye-opening for me when I learned about how a lot of these sophisticated phishing attacks work. And so they often start with getting access to the internal network, right? So the most common way to get access to your system is using phishing. And, you know, a lot of times, I think we were talking about this before we got on the pod, but I think sometimes now you have attackers who are also giving you personalized phishing emails. So think about the stuff that you're working on based on your search history. That's the kind of phishing emails that you get. And North Korean hackers have done this exact same implementation in the past, where they send an email which has a Word document attached. You click on that open document and it executes a macro or some kind of code that installs a Trojan right away. And so, you know, this is something which I was learning about, but this is where a lot of these US-based companies that have remote roles open, that's where I think you see a lot of, you know, hackers or attackers applying for these remote-only jobs. And their only job is to not get into the system, but it's only to get a recruiter to click on your resume Word file. And as soon as the recruiter clicks on the resume Word file, which the hacker has submitted, that's when the macro, the execution file gets started. And then they start out with this strategy called lateral movement, where they use one compromised machine to get another compromised machine until they get to the laptop, which has all the target funds, which in this case would be the 3 of 3 or 3 of 5. It's not that they exploited a smart contract bug. I think this was extremely sophisticated, possibly took months to get to this part.
I think that last piece that you mentioned is really important, right? And that is the core cryptography that secures these multi-sig wallets was not compromised. It's the UI and the process for the human process for interacting with them that was, right? And that is maybe a little different than what we're used to seeing as far as crypto hacks go, right? There's been a ton of smart contract exploitation. And yes, when we think about self-custody and wallet management, like, these types of things do happen, but it's actually now, at least, less prevalent than it was, especially as you compare it to some of the other types of hacks that can occur, right? But this is the largest in history. This is a very, very material loss. And Bybit actually seems to be able to absorb it to a certain extent. You know, this isn't, you know, at least right now, doesn't seem like this is going to be the end of them or the end of their business. I know, you know, they're continuing to honor withdrawals. They've secured a few different bridge loans from a number of their partners in the ecosystem to be able to, I think they did see quite an exodus in terms of withdrawals, you know, immediately following the hack. But I think I saw a report last night or this morning that said that's started to slow down. So, I mean, it seems like they will survive and customer funds in general are safe or okay, right? But there is still a $1.5 billion loss here. You know, well, it was a $1.5 billion loss. I don't know. There's been a big sell-off, but a big loss, you know, an over $1 billion loss that will have to be, you know, accounted for eventually, right? And that's super unfortunate. But I guess, you know, the silver lining is there's going to be a lot of learnings for other providers. And there was no like immediate collateral damage with respect to client funds like there has been with some of these other exploitations.
Yeah, I think that leads into a point that you were mentioning, Parth, before we jumped on here, which is how Bybit managed this. I mean, it's a massive crisis, and I think that they did a really good job. If you want to touch on that.
I believe Bybit delivered a masterclass in crisis management. The first message came within 30 minutes after there was a public report on the hack. And it didn't come from a random corporate account of Bybit. It actually came from the CEO himself. So both Bybit and Ben took ownership, and that became the primary communication channel. And the best part was they also had really fast, transparent follow-ups where they spoke in detail on why they think their funds are backed. And the CEO went on a live stream. This is, again, you know, this was probably past bedtime for, so this is like probably 2 a.m. in like Dubai. For him, but he went on a live stream so people could ask questions right away. And one part which I really liked about the live stream was that he was being extremely clear with timelines, numbers, and plans. He did tell how many withdrawals are pending, how many hours it would take to clear them. The other part of their strategy was that they made sure retail customers were prioritized over institutions for withdrawals, which I think is a great strategy, right? Because it kind of it makes sure that it contains that negative information. And then throughout this live stream, this is really interesting. So throughout the live stream, Bybit assumed that the hackers were watching, and they emphasized on how hard it's going to be for the hackers to cash out their stolen funds, and even inviting them to a negotiation table. They also spoke about how this part is hacked and what they have done now to make sure that it's more secure. So the other part is, Ryan, you spoke about the bridge loans which Bybit has been able to secure from Binance and BitGet. And that was also possible because Bybit had a one-to-one asset backing with proof of reserves, which is why they were able to secure those loans so quickly and continue to process a lot of the withdrawals. So I think you could see that they had possibly done a few reps of these crises before it actually happened.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And it really, I mean, as I was watching the live stream, I was, again, like floored at how well it was handled and how it compares to certain other crises that have occurred within this space. You know, I think it was night and day different.
Well, like, and the truth is like when something like this happens, others learn from it, right? So I think that's Parth, you're the one who made the point, like it shows almost like a maturation in kind of how the industry is evolving, which is a good thing, right? It's a really bad incident, but hopefully some of what can come from it longer term will be good. We didn't, in terms of the remediation, we didn't talk about the bounty program, which is fairly common, but I think, what is it, like a 10% bounty, or did they increase it? It's at 10%, right? And they're willing to give like 5% in advance as like a gesture of goodwill that you'll this applies to, I think, some of like the DEXs that are being used to, you know, conceal these funds, right? And you know, exchange these funds for other types of digital assets, right? So I think there's already been some cooperation. I mean, I don't think it's been super material in terms of the overall losses, but I want to say I saw one of the DEXs like froze like $40 million worth of one of the wrapped, I think it was one of the wrapped Ethereum products.
Before this, they were purely focused on Bitcoin. They would try to target and figure out ways to convert whatever cash they have, whatever assets they have, into Bitcoin. But now they have, you know, $1.4 billion, 400,000 ETH. But the other problem here is that what we have seen in the past is that this group just has diamond hands. Like, they don't move their funds for years. They don't move their funds until it's the right time, there's a right crypto liquidation event. And because it seems like it's also so state-backed that I think that's where it gets really interesting on how they don't have to encash on the money as, you know, right now. One of the, U.S. cybersecurity officials, Anna Neuberger, she mentioned that close to 30% of North Korea's missile program is actually funded by cybercrime. So they have these war chests from hacking. In 2022 alone, they stole around $1.7 billion. And now, as of today, the Lazarus Group, you know, has 0.42% of ETH, which is more Ethereum than the Ethereum Foundation owns, more Ethereum than Vitalik himself.
Yeah, no, that's a really powerful stat. And I saw this, I think, the same report or a similar report that talked about, you know, the blueprint that they use for these attacks. This is a very, very sophisticated group that facilitated this attack. And I think I've read a couple of the different forensics reports, and the word that kind of stuck out across all of them was meticulous and meticulously planned, right? So this wasn't, you know, this wasn't somebody in a basement somewhere, right?
Yeah,
That was able to do this, which does happen, by the way, with some of like the bridge exploits or other smart contract exploits, right? This is not that, which I think is important to highlight. So what do we think? Like, I guess to that end, what do we think changes moving forward? I mean, I think the immediate is like people are going to really look at their OPSEC, right, and making sure that, some of those kind of attack vectors are as guarded as they could potentially be. Is there anything else that you can think of, Parth or Gotham or Matt, that, you know, you would see as like an immediate change that would be made by some of these exchanges and custodians?
Obviously, I think we're going to see a lot of, you know, companies start to, pay attention to this and ensure that like employees are, you know, following, you know, phishing training and ensuring that like, not clicking on posts and stuff like that to ensure vulnerabilities. I also think you'll probably see a lot of enhanced like monitoring and response mechanisms for other companies as well to like implement. So like just rapid detection and responses to mitigate impacts in breaches. And I think you're just going to see a lot of the professionalism that like, you know, Bybit CEO kind of presented there. Like, just, I think to give them credit, they were very transparent in the response and with their customers. And I think hopefully a lot of CEOs kind of like should, you know, reflect that example.
To be honest with you, it's kind of hard to see the silver lining here because we've seen these kind of attacks. I don't want to be a Debbie Downer.
I was trying to be positive, but yeah, I agree with you to a certain extent. Like, it's impossible to, I mean, this is a very, very bespoke thing that happened, right? And like other bespoke things could potentially happen moving forward, right?
Yeah, and the other part is that I think we have seen the exact same kind of hacks in the past by the same group. Like, they hacked 230 million of funds from Wazirex, which is a crypto exchange based out of India, with the exact same. It's the only difference was the amount, the value, and then the amount of press that it got. But I think the question is,
that was a multi-sig attack as well.
So I'm not sure it was a multi-sig, but I think it started off with phishing. So they got into their internal server systems, but I'm sure it wasn't the same AWS S3 bucket. But I guess the question is, how can companies that offer crypto products at least make things harder for attackers in the future? And like Gotham said, the first one is training employees on phishing. The second one is, if you are a crypto company, you have to heavily lock down any sort of hardware that connects to cold storage. That becomes paramount. That's table stakes now versus, you know, what it used to be. It was nice to have 3 years ago, is now table stakes. And the other is, I'm also seeing a lot of exploration around implementing a cosigner. So have a cosigner, which is a security firm that looks at the signature message, looks at the transaction, provides you the final check. And it's a separate module that is offered by some security companies. It makes the entire process more slow, but I think it's worth it for massive amounts. So that's kind of my three quick steps. But again, like I said, it's hard to find a silver lining out of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe if just at a high level, what a big silver lining could be is just the continued development and maturation of the custody business, and understanding that custody is a very intense business that requires a lot of forethought and crisis management and like really being on top of like what your risk factors are. You know, any custody business that custodies a large amount of crypto, right?
Yeah. My prediction is that I think you'll see so many crypto security companies in the next 1 to 2 years, similar to how you saw cybersecurity as a new industry, which came out of nowhere when you had the internet getting more mainstream. I think we just haven't invested enough. Like when I think about it, I know possibly 4 security companies, and maybe, you know, a few of them actually have had, you know, issues in the past, which is such a small number for the amount of crypto we are trying to secure. So I think if you're an aspiring developer, if you want to build a product, I think there's a strong chance that you'll get some traction around cybersecurity for crypto. The other part, which I think is worth mentioning, is that even for the Lazarus group, I think, like we said, they have diamond hands, but they're so sophisticated that they've already spread those 400,000 ETH across 59 or more wallets. And they've done tiny transactions. Some of that money has already gone through mixers, which means that it was dirty and now it's not clean, but it's obfuscated. And then they've also used some of that money to go through cross-chain bridges. So some funds were moved to other blockchains like Binance Smart Chain using bridges. So it's just, you know, it's a classic case of laundering cash by swapping it for gift cards and trading those for something else and trading that for something else. So you know, good luck tracing it back. And I think that's why it becomes so important to be an on-chain sleuth and also focus on cybersecurity.
I know the sleuths really came through for us on this one, didn't they?
Yeah.
As did all the Chainalysis companies, of course, right? And forensics companies. This will be an interesting one to watch as we move forward. I think there's, you know, a lot still to be uncovered, but certainly one of the biggest kind of, as we said, negative events to happen in a number of years. So, all right, guys. Well, thank you. Great discussion. It was good seeing you all, and we'll talk to you soon. And thanks everyone for joining.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2025 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.